Welcome to Author Stories, the podcast where we talk to the best writers in the industry and discuss writing and the creative process. Whether you are a writer, a reader, or both, we hope you'll find something here that makes you love books and the writers that create them. You can find archives of all of the great conversations I've had with authors over the years at hankgarner.com. Take some time and browse around there. I'm sure you'll find a new author to love, find inspiration for your own creative life, and find a new story to get lost in. The story behind the stories is what you get here, and today we talk with Rex Ogle. Rex joins me to talk about his new book, Free Lunch, a really unique look at poverty and how it affects kids, told through the eyes of a sixth grader. Now, this might seem like heavy subject matter, and it is, but Rex is an amazingly gifted storyteller, and you will be hooked from the beginning and quickly rooting for young Rex. It's a very entertaining read. Before we get to today's interview with Rex, let's thank some folks that make this show possible. RJ Pinero and his brand new book, Chilling Effect, a Global Climate Thriller. A ruthless eco-terrorist, a woman determined to stop him. Chilling Effect, RJ Pinero's newest thriller, explores a world in the not-too-distant future where terrorism is taken to a new level, one with world-ending consequences. You never know what you're capable of until the monster inside of you pushes you beyond your moral line in the sand. These are the opening thoughts of former climatologist William Christed as he prepares to attack our delicate ecosystem. He's hell-bent on avenging his father's death and will go to extremes of terrorism never before seen, all to strike a blow to those whose hubris led to his father's demise. He will take full advantage of the greed and narcissism ever present in the world, as well as the fragility of our planet to ecological terrorism, and use it to plot a scenario so grim, yet so compellingly real, it could have ripped from today's headlines. Check out the brand new thriller Chilling Effect from RJ Pinero. Michael Anderle has a brand new series that's launching. It's called Opus X, and the first book is Obsidian Detective. Two rebels whose worlds collide on a planetary level. On the fringes of human space, a murder will light a fuse and send two different people colliding together. She lives on Earth, where peace among the population is a given. He is on the fringe of society, where authority is how much power you wield. She's from the powerful, the elite, he's with the military. Both want the truth, but is revealing the truth good for society? Check out Obsidian Detective, the very first book that's up for pre-order now, from the new series Opus X by Michael Anderle. If you love comics the way I do, go check out Cool Comics in My Collection at edgosney.com. Ed runs one of the best comics blogs on the internet. New episodes each Thursday come out, digging into the things that we have loved about comics and comic collecting. There's something there for everyone. Go check out Cool Comics in My Collection at edgosney.com. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm super excited to have Rex Ogle on the show with me today. He has a phenomenal new book. It's called Free Lunch, and this book has a little bit of everything. I think you're going to understand what I'm saying in just a minute when we start talking about it. Welcome to the show, Rex.
Much appreciated. Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to have you. Rex, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
You know what? I was thinking about that this morning, and I remember when I was about six, I was obsessed with three things, writing and drawing my own comics, space travel, and monkeys. And I wrote my first story, which was essentially about me sneaking onto a NASA rocket with a monkey and flying to the moon. And I wrote and drew that, and I think I did like 24 pages fully illustrated. And I was so proud of it. It was just like, there was no sense of accomplishment like writing my own story. And I think from that moment on, I fell in love with storytelling and knew that's what I wanted to do with my life.
Comic space and monkeys seems perfectly reasonable to me. I think I went through that phase as well. That's awesome. When did you grow up? What was your your decade that defined you?
So I was born in 1978, and my dad was in the Air Force, so we moved around a lot the first 5 years of my life. I was born in Abilene, Texas, but we ended up in Okinawa and Japan and then in Guam. So we didn't come back to the United States till I was 4 and a half, so that was 82. So even though I am definitely an 80s baby or an 80s kid, it's funny because I feel like I'm 5 years younger because I missed a lot of pop culture from those first 5 years. That probably set the stage for me being a kid at heart.
Love it. I love it. Your love of comics and you talked about drawing your own. Did you approach them from a writing or an artwork standpoint, or do you even make those distinctions? Do comics kind of become a third thing?
I definitely think there's a distinction, especially as I got older. I took a lot of art classes, and I had a lot of wonderful, amazing art teachers, but there was one that was particularly honest with me. And she's like, "You have an amazing knack for stories." She's like, "Your art isn't quite there." She's like, "But you should really focus on just writing." She's like, "You're really good with words. When you describe, when you talk about your art, it's amazing. The art, not so much." And it was kind of harsh at the time, but it's exactly what I needed to hear because I did love writing. And I wish I was also an artist, but I am definitely not. I am a writer through and through.
I have a daughter who is just a natural visual artist, and she's in art school right now. But the things that she comes up with just in her doodles just amaze me because I can have a great vision in my head and my hands do not know what to do with that. And I think there's just some things that you're just naturally skilled with, and you know, but God love them. I appreciate people like that. I really appreciate teachers. I like to talk about that a lot on the show. These people that give these little nuggets of encouragement, to a kid, and it doesn't cost the teacher anything, or you know, other people of influence in your life. And there are some really dark, lonely days of being a writer, and those little encouragements from people really go a long way. Did that teacher, how do you feel about that encouragement that she gave you to, that your writing was good? Has that helped you along the way?
It really has. I mean, because it's funny, like I think back to my teachers, and there were just three that stood out. The first one was Miss Gibson, who was my first art teacher, who just always encouraged me to keep going, keep going, keep going. And she kept pushing me, even though my art wasn't there. And then Miss Sanders, the art teacher, who was like, maybe focus on writing. And then there was also Miss Humphrey, who was an English teacher who I had for 2 years in a row. And I mean, she just was always, the three of them were always so encouraging and always so positive. And I love those teachers so much because I think of them all the time when I'm writing, and I'm like, I think they'd be really proud of me.
What did you decide to pursue career-wise?
I grew up pretty poor, as you'll learn about in the book. We were on welfare. When we first moved back to the States, we were in a trailer, and then my parents got divorced, and then that kind of set the stage for the rest of my childhood. Because my dad went off and, you know, made some money. My mom, on the other hand, went the opposite direction. And, you know, she went from having a job to not having a job. And so for me, I always knew that I wanted to do something. And in the back of my head, I was like, I need to be a lawyer. I need to be a doctor. I need to make money so I can take care of myself. But there was always something that always drew me back to books. So in college, I was like, you know what? You only get to live once. I might as well pursue my passion. So I didn't want to be a starving artist or a starving writer in this case. So I decided, you know, I'm going to work in publishing. So I moved to New York City and pursued jobs in publishing. And I ended up working at Marvel Comics, DC Comics, Scholastic Books, and then Little Brown for Young Readers. Over the course of 15 years. And it's so funny because I ended up working on all these things that I loved as a kid. Like I worked on superheroes like Batman and Superman, and of course the X-Men, which is my all-time favorite. When I was at Scholastic, I was working on license titles with brands like Lego and Star Wars and Power Rangers, and then at Little Brown I was working with Transformers and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So I really made a career out of working on the things that I loved as a kid and telling new stories in the universes that I loved.
Well, looking back over your bio information and kind of digging around in your LinkedIn page, and I'm reading and my jaw is just agape with all of the cool stuff that you've gotten to do. And as a kid, I'm a little bit older than you, but not a lot. And coming from that same kind of place in time and place in the world, man, you talk about dream jobs. That is just like living the dream. Well, also, having read your book and kind of understanding your background, and we're going to talk more about the book in just a minute. But, it's really interesting to me that a kid that came up in the circumstances that you did still maintained and held on to that optimism, that there's still hope in the world. And I think that that doesn't happen for a lot of people, that you kind of come from meager circumstances, and the notion is to just find something solid, stable, and take all of the danger out of the world. And of course, you had great jobs, which obviously provided, but that has to be a leap of faith to believe that things are still possible, and that you can pursue artistic expressions and make money doing it.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I feel like my childhood in many ways set the stage for the rest of my life. It's so funny because my first book is called Free Lunch, and it's basically about being hungry, not just hungry for food, but hungry for love and hungry for hope and hungry for just something better than what I had offered to me. And I think that hunger is kind of what propelled me forward. And, that hunger made me go to the library and devour books. And then in high school, like, make good grades in hopes that I'd be able to go to college. And then in college, I worked two or three jobs at a time while going to college and taking full course loads. And then after college, it's like, I was hungry for more. And I knew that I needed to do something with books, something with words, something that I loved, because I didn't want to be a lawyer, a doctor, and be unhappy in my circumstances and be one of those people who worked and worked and worked and then found himself to be 80 and regretting not having gone back and done all the things he wanted to do. So it's like I did. And I will say, like, while I wasn't a starving artist, I mean, working in publishing, especially in comic books and book publishing, it did not, living in New York City, I'm like, there really should be some kind of stipend for those people, because you barely pay the bills. So while I was working on all these brands that I loved, I mean, I think when I was an assistant, I was making like 30 grand a year, which in New York City, that half of that goes to taxes right off the bat. So, so I was always freelancing or bartending or, waiting tables just to make ends meet, but I was doing what I loved and I was able to smile about it at the end of the day. And I think that really helped.
As someone who's gotten to work in the comics industry, that's a resilient industry. We're talking with DC Comics 80 years or better, and Marvel 60-ish years or better. And it's really intriguing on a lot of levels. But we've got these characters that have lasted for decades, and we keep finding new things to do with them and put them in. But as a medium, what do you think about the future of comics, and will these things survive in this digital world? And, lots of things are changing.
Yeah, things are changing. It's funny because when I went into comic books, I mean, that was a good dream come true. And then I moved over to Scholastic, which, I think there's memes on the internet saying I'm still chasing that feeling of going to a Scholastic book fair as a
yes.
kid. And I mean, very much like when I walked into those halls, it was like a dream come true. And, because I remember the feeling and the smell and the colors of those flyers when I was in second and third and fourth grade. And so for me to walk in those hallowed halls and become part of that, that industry or that company, it was just so amazing. But I kind of made it my platform coming over to make books for reluctant readers, because at first I was a bit of a reluctant reader. I loved reading, but I had very specific tastes, and if something didn't intrigue me right off the bat, I wasn't interested. So I wanted to make books for kids, especially boys and girls who found reading difficult or looked at a 300-page prose novel and they're like, that's too much. I can't read that. That's scary. And I wanted to make things more easily accessible. And I remember Diary of a Wimpy Kid had come out probably like 5 years before I was at Scholastic. And I was just blown away because I was like, this is so smart. This is a brand new medium. It's a hybrid of comics and prose because it takes the art. And there's an entire generation of kids who are coming up on the internet. I mean, I think we're the last generation who knows what the world was like before the internet. So these kids are growing up on their phones and on their iPads or their parents' computers, like looking at the internet, which is so much text, but also so much art. And so a lot of what I worked on was very much in that Diary of a Wimpy Kid format. And I think that kids more and more are gravitating towards graphic novels and sequential storytelling because it's more in line with what they see technology wise. And it's just easier to consume for them. So I have a good feeling about comics. I don't know that Marvel and DC are going to stay the same. Like I think that, you know, the comics as a medium itself or as a format, you know, that came about back in the 30s, I think, because newspaper printers were trying to find ways to keep the presses running and making money in between Sunday editions. And now it's like, you know, trees are scarce and paper recycling is becoming more and more expensive. So I worry about comics. I wish comics would stay alive for, you know, the next 500 years, but who knows with how the environment and the green stuff in our world is happening, like if that will continue, but it'll be interesting. I will say that I feel like everything is just super interesting watching the world change.
It is. I was having a conversation with someone the other day and talking about how my mom gave me a couple of comic books when I was 6 or 7, and those helped me work through my dyslexia that I have. And he was saying that, you know, that was really forward thinking of a mom in the 70s. Now we encourage kids to read anything as long as they're reading. Yeah. And I think comics have really kind of met some mainstream acceptance for once, thank God. And I'm like you. I hope we find a way to keep the form alive.
Yeah, agreed.
So you're working in the industry, Marvel, DC, Scholastic. When do you start thinking about this story that becomes Free Lunch? And I know it's your story, but when do you start thinking about kind of gathering your thoughts on it and finding a narrative structure for what happened to you?
Well, I always knew I wanted to be a writer. And for the longest time, you know, I wanted to be, you know, Stephen King or Anne Rice or J.K. Rowling and write these big fantastical stories, very genre, you know, either horror or science fiction. And that's very much what I gravitated towards. And, you know, I was living in New York in my 20s and, you know, I would work all day and then come home and I'd write from like 6 p.m. till midnight every night. And I'd write these, you know, YA novels or middle grade novels. And I'd, you know, send them out to agents trying to find someone to represent me and got hundreds of passes. And then, you know, once I started working at Scholastic and I started making actual industry contacts, you know, they'd pass and I'd be like, well, could I get some kind of note, something constructive? Like the voice doesn't resonate with me, doesn't give me anything to work with. And I'm a workhorse. Like, tell me what to fix and I'll fix it. And they all said the same thing. There's no heart. There's no emotion. And it's funny because I think I was good with world building and I was good with dialogue and I was good with characters. But what I was lacking was true emotion. And the funny thing is that I was running desperately from my childhood. I didn't want to think about my past. I didn't want to think what I lived through. I wanted to ignore it. I didn't want to talk about it. Probably about 6 years ago, I moved from Scholastic to Little Brown, and Little Brown is very much like a literary publishing company, and they just published so many amazing books that won so many awards, And it was so different from what I was used to at Scholastic, which was a lot of commercial books and just very wide audiences, but not literary. And so I was, you know, going to these editorial meetings and I was listening to these people talk. And I started to realize it was like, what the authors at Little Brown have that I lack completely is that they're in touch with their emotions. They're in touch with the hard parts of life. And those were the things that I was running from. And I was embarrassed about and ashamed about, because my childhood was about being embarrassed to go to school in shoes with holes in them and secondhand shirts that my mom had picked up at Salvation Army or Goodwill. It was about being embarrassed that I was on the free lunch program and being mocked endlessly because my mom, you know, we were poor, but she's like, you're going to get a good education. And she moved us to Grapevine, which at the time was like the richest school district in Texas. And so even though she was unemployed, we were at a really good school district, but the kids were coming to school in BMWs and wearing Prada, which at the time I didn't even know that Prada was like what that meant. I just thought Prada meant like, these people have money. And so these kids would pull out wads of 10s and 20s to pay for their lunches. And I would have to go up there and say, I'm in the free lunch program. And kids are like, why do you get your lunch for free? And it was just such a huge source of shame and embarrassment that as an adult, I was like, no one wants to read about that stuff. No kid wants to read about this. This is depressing. No one wants to be depressed. Life is depressing enough. And then I worked at Little Brown and realized, actually, maybe some people do want to read about right. stuff that they're not looking at it as this book is depressing, but this book is about real life. This is right. what people go through. And so that's about the time that I started working on free lunch and I started outlining it and really putting my heart into it. And it was not easy.
I bet. Did you realize from the beginning that the free lunch metaphor was going to be as powerful and as all-encompassing as it turned out to be?
Honestly, no. I knew that I liked the title Free Lunch and that it made sense for the story I wanted to tell, which was about me being on the free lunch program. But it took me years, I think, as I was writing the chapters and revisiting those emotional moments and how it felt, like really digging into the nitty gritty, raw emotions of those circumstances to really understand how hungry I was as a kid and how that kind of informed the rest of my life.
You start realizing pretty quickly in the story that the free lunch metaphor goes much deeper than actual lunch. And how long did it take you to work through what the narrative of this book was going to be? And how did you choose to lock us into this the sixth grade point of view? Like, you know, when we're talking about memoir and that type of story, I'm always fascinated by what lens the author chooses, that we see the story through this perspective and it encompasses this time period. Like what drove you to encapsulating the story at this point?
Well, I was on the free lunch program for sixth grade through ninth grade. At that point I was working enough on my own that I had money. So I started paying for my lunch because I just couldn't will myself to ask for a free lunch in high school. But so originally I wanted the story to take place over 4 years and that spanned a lot. And I had so many ideas about different things that I went through in high school, everything from, you know, how I felt about religion to how I felt about politics and then the domestic violence at home to the poverty angle. And I think it was just too much. And I was like, I really need to hone in on something. And sixth grade it just seems like the right story beats because it was that, you know, you're moving from elementary to middle school, which in itself is already a big leap for a lot of kids. Like it's scary. Like I have nieces and nephews who it's like right as they're starting middle school are like freaking out a little bit. They're like, it's like high school, but scarier. And so it's, I think that as I was really honing in on it, I was like, I think that sixth grade is the perfect time, because it's not just about, you know, which table do I sit at a new school and what kids do I hang out with and how do I navigate hallways and locker combinations and, you know, choosing electives, but it's also, you know, wanting to fit in and wanting to be like the other kids and not feel different. And that's also about the age where bodies are changing and kids can get mean. I mean, it's not an easy time for anyone, I think, at that age. But it's especially hard when you already feel like you're an outsider.
Right. Well, with our kids, you definitely see these changes in their kind of little kid society. Elementary school, everyone's friends, and when you get to sixth and seventh grade, weird things happen. And all of our kids, if they ever had trouble at school with bullies or you know, cliques and all of that, it always happened in sixth and seventh grade. It's so bizarre. It's that was the perfect lens to tell this story through, because it absolutely resonated. Did you ever consider telling this story from a different perspective, or as adult Rex, you know, talking about it, or was that always your voice for this book?
The first draft was actually from my point of view as a 35-year-old adult. And, you know, I sent it out to one agent and she was like, it's interesting as a memoir, but she's like, it'd be so much more interesting from the child's perspective. And it was funny because there were times when I would jump into that voice and I was kind of jumping back and forth between the adult voice and the child's voice. And I think I was just scared. I was scared to dive back in there and really get into the details and remember all that stuff, because I have like an uncanny memory. I always have since I was a kid. Like, I remember things from when I lived in Guam and Okinawa, like that as a kid, like in middle school and high school, I'd be like, yeah, I remember this island and there was a pig with an apple in its mouth and it was on, you know, they put him in the fire. And they're like, my parents were like, yeah, that's exactly what happened. Like, you're recalling stuff from when you were 3 and 4. So I've always had like an uncanny memory, and it's unfortunate because, well, it's both fortunate and unfortunate because I remember so much of my childhood with such extreme detail. And it's like going back into the memories, and I see myself not always in the best light. I wasn't always the nicest kid. I definitely fought for myself, but at times I was also cruel to other kids and an little jerk to my mom. And so, yeah, it was hard to go back, and because your instinct is to be like, oh, I'm going to write myself as like this good kid who is always doing the right thing, but that's not true. And that's not accurate. So I really tried to dig in, especially to those hard parts where I don't come off in the best light, but I wanted to be honest.
Well, and when you really start digging into those experiences, you kind of realize the truth of that adage, that hurt people. And that helps you to gain empathy for other people. I think when you realize I was hurting, therefore I was lashing out at people, man, I wonder what this other kid is going through with his bad behavior.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing is, one of the story threads in Free Lunch has to do with my best friend, or the kid who would become my best friend, who it's like, when I first met him, I was like, this kid is so weird. He is so bizarre. Why is he talking to me? And it was almost more like, I was like, if he wants to talk to me after I've been rejected by all my friends from elementary school, there must be something wrong with him. And it was a lack of self-confidence on my part. And then as we grew to know each other and we had so many similar interests, but I had assumed that he just had the perfect life because he seemed so level-headed and he seemed so confident and he dressed nice and he came to school with a brown bag lunch, meaning, you know, his parents packed him a lunch so that his parents must really love him and his parents must be perfect. And by the end of the story, you know, he hints that, you know what, his life isn't perfect either. And that was shocking to me because I was like, but your parents give you a lunch. You don't have to beg for lunch or anything. So it's just funny how, at least for me, I was so ingrained and so lost in my own suffering, I didn't realize that other people could be suffering.
In your time at Little Brown, where you started really watching what books were connecting with people and why those books were connecting, and you started looking for that emotional connection and moving away from more commercial interest, and I'm using air quotes commercial because I kind of hate those designations, but we all understand what we're talking about. And this book is finished and out in the world now. How do you feel about your writing now, and what you hope to pursue in the future? Will you go back to more genre writing, or are you kind of hooked in this place now?
Well, it's funny because I love sci-fi fantasy still. I'm still a huge fan of X-Men and go every Wednesday to my local comic book store and pick up my books. But I feel like writing Free Lunch was an eye-opening experience because it was the first time that I wrote something that I was like, this is an important story to tell. This could really help people. And I mean, I love genre writing because it's an escape, and it's an escape from harsh realities. But I'm already working on the sequel to Free Lunch, and I kind of have a 3, maybe a 4 year plan with a book to write a book each year. I think they may take longer than I thought because it is so hard to go back and revisit this stuff. But I'm really enjoying this voice and revisiting this stuff. And at the same time, I will say I do feel completely arrogant because I'm like, who am I? Like, I'm not any more important than anybody else. But at the same time, I do think there's something about having grown up in a trailer park and having asked for a free lunch and having worn secondhand clothes that I feel like a lot of people who live through that don't get the chance to write books because they end up working so hard for the rest of their lives, or they're a little too scared to pursue writing, or they think just like me and they're like, who am I? Well, like, why would I write a book? Why? I'm not important. I'm nobody. And it's that kind of lack of confidence that stops them from writing. And that's why I think this is an important story to tell and why I should keep writing, because on one hand, I guess it is a little arrogant, but at the same time, like, someone's got to do it. Someone has to tell these stories.
Exactly. It's not arrogance. We're standing up for the folks who can't tell their story, and that's why this is so important. The new book is called Free Lunch. It's available everywhere now, in hardcover and Kindle edition. Rex, it's been so much fun talking. I am going to send everyone to pick up their copy of Free Lunch. There's links to it in the show notes of this episode. Is there a place online where people can connect with you if they are just learning about you and want to find out more?
I am on Facebook and I'm on Instagram. Rex Ogle on Facebook and Instagram is Third Rex.
Excellent. We're going to send everybody to see you. Rex, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's much appreciated.
Thanks to Rex Ogle for joining me today. You can find all of the archives of the show at hankgarner.com. Leave us a comment to show some love for the show and for our guests. Be sure to use the Amazon links in the show notes and show some support for the authors that we have and for the show. Stay tuned now for an audiobook clip from Richard Gleeb's The Jason Crane Series.
Jason yanked the coils of safety rope to one shoulder and heaved them out the attic window. The bundle bounced over the roofline and dropped to the yard below. He tightened the harness, making sure the shoulder straps were snug over his sweatshirt. He threaded his rope through the braking device, tested it, and clipped everything to the carabiner at his navel. So far, so good. Fireman Mike would be proud. His stomach flipped as he neared the octagonal window. Had he tied the correct knots? Would he get himself killed? Weeks had passed since Mike's tutorial and... But he had to attempt the break-in now, while both Van Brunts were at the Christmas Eve service. He swung his legs through the window and felt for the roof. His sneakers gripped the shingles and he wriggled out, grateful for once to have feet as big as snowshoes. He pulled on a ski mask and sang, Spider-Man, Spider-Man, does whatever a spider can. He lowered his body. Wind punched him in the jaw like a supervillain, surprising him. His sweatshirt rode up and snow burrowed into his navel. He looked down but couldn't see his feet. He relaxed his hands and put a few ounces of weight on the rope. Clots of snow broke away, dove over the edge, and took far too long to hit ground. He drew his rope around the pipe and pulled tight. Now he could drop. No, you will not drop. You will rappel. You will rappel very safely. He backed towards the edge, towards the point of no return. The backyard lurched into view. It was a four-story fall, and he'd probably hit the stairs on the way down. He sledded helplessly. His legs fell, swung, and kicked the side of the house. Alarm bells went off in his head. He gripped the rope. It looked like nothing. A shoelace. Jason Crane, you're a damn fool. He went limp and fell over. The rope gave a jolt, and the harness tried to castrate him. He twisted, trying to save his poor descendants. He began to spin. His arm bashed through a row of icicles. The spin slowed, reversed, and at last he came to a stop with his back to the house, dangling over the backyard. Thank you, rope. That's a good rope. Well done. He tried to turn around, but couldn't. With patience, he worked out a method of kicking in circles and managed to press his sneakers to the side of the house. He needed slack. He gathered his loose rope to the small of his back and disengaged the brake. Zip! He fell fast, all his weight on the rope now. His feet, planted, shot up over his head. The brake caught him, and the rope vibrated as wildly as a guitar string striking a note of panic. Jason heard a crunching sound and looked up. The leaf gutter crumpled and poured a stream of bitter ice water into his eyes. He snarled and wiped his face, dripping humiliation. Jason rested a moment and stared at his reflection in the glass. He was an enormous Macy's balloon drifting over New Jersey, tethered at the navel like Underdog. How the hell did you get up here, kid? He did an awkward split, one foot above the window and the other below, hanging sideways with his weight on one hip. He closed his eyes and reached for the sill, crouching against the side of the house. His fingernails found the weather stripping, and he tugged. Locked. He cursed and tugged again, anger rising. He grabbed the frame with both hands and pulled with all his spider strength. Something popped. The window rose and the curtains splashed out. Jason dove headfirst into the fabric, wriggled and kicked, let out some rope and fell with a whump into his archenemy's lair.